I'm good. Ron?
Yep.
Okay, Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Wednesday, March 4th, 2015, will come to order. What is this little thing we got in front of us? Science Museum, people. I should probably wait till we have more people in here to... Yeah, do we have a quorum yet? One, two, no, okay. Okay. Dr. Jolly, you want to come to the table? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. With me today is John Severson, our director for corporate and government relations. And if you'll indulge me for just a minute, I'll explain what's sitting in front of you.
Okay.
This wonderful little device is called a rattleback. If you place it in front of you and spin it counterclockwise, you'll notice it does something completely expected. It spins. But if you take the same piece and you spin it clockwise, it will reverse its direction.
Like winds itself up and goes backwards.
It goes backwards. If you just tap it, it will go in one direction. The reason if you tap it, it goes in that one direction is there are three axes of symmetry in here. The long axis along the flat plane, the short axis, and the vertical axis. The center of gravity for each of these axes is in a different place in this piece. So when you spin it counterclockwise, you are going to tip it onto its primary axis, and it will spin along the average point of all of them, therefore spin with ease. But if you spin it clockwise, you're forcing its momentum against the center of gravity of the short axis. It rotates on that short axis the same way it does when you tap it, and the rotational force transfers the energy to a counterclockwise direction. Three axes of symmetry with no one center of gravity is what causes this phenomenal effect. These were first discovered by Roman soldiers as they marched through building the roads of Rome, different streams, and they would find stones that were spinning from the rushing water. Today they're found commonly as celts in the Celtic and in Greek digs, as they were a toy, a kind of top that people would bring to their children. Naturally occurring, I've found them in Stillwater, Minnesota, in the streams. But even easier to find is online at Amazon.com. They're a wonderful way to demonstrate design functions and how beautiful and functional engineering can be to our children. There's something I also use to teach parents. And that is, no matter how you put energy into this, it's going to spin in one direction. And if the child doesn't want to go that way, it's just a loss of your energy. Recognize some things are designed to just go in one direction. With that, Mr. Chair, I would love to talk about our...
Hopefully our legislative session goes in one direction.
I hope so. I appreciate so much the committee's time today. I would like to speak to two...
I would like to ask a question about that thing, but I don't have any idea what I want to ask. Does anybody want to ask him a question about this thing and what it really... what is it really? No, I mean, what is it?
This is a plastic model of what used to be a rock.
Yeah.
It's a rattleback, is the name that we give to it, and it's an engineering marvel that we use to teach issues of balance in design. And so you begin to understand the power of a center of gravity, moments of inertia, and I use it to teach three particular physics formulas. I would be delighted to teach those physics formulas, but I'm not certain if it's the time you want to dedicate today.
Not now, but...
They're how fun, they're it, easy, and I guarantee you'll get an A.
How long will it take?
Oh, it'll take about 15 minutes.
So. All right, let's go to the other thing then.
The other things would be two appropriations from the Science Museum of Minnesota. In the left side of the booklet that we handed out, you'll see information on our general fund request, and on the right side, our legacy request. Our general fund request for the Science Museum of Minnesota this year is $1,079,000. It is flat from the last biennium. It is sufficient to meet our needs. We appreciate so much the support that we received last year from this legislature, and would like to talk for just a moment about what that $1,079,000 means to the Science Museum of Minnesota. That's just under 3% of our total budget. And that may seem like a small amount to a number of people here, but it is among the most critical set of dollars that the Science Museum of Minnesota receives. We leverage that money in ways that brings benefits to the state in such far greater measure than what that appropriation represents. We don't have as much trouble finding someone who wants to sponsor a cell lab, a great space exhibit, a wonderful piece on human body and health care, or even early childhood development. We didn't have difficulty finding people who wanted to sponsor the race exhibit and lead America into a conversation that started here, a bold conversation. But I have trouble finding people who want to put up a sign that says, the spots were taken out of your rug by, the windows were washed by, and the like. And so we maintain a clean and safe building with funding that we find hard to generate anywhere else. And we use that as a foundation for so much of our other work. It took my staff a long time to stop cringing when I used the phrase, but I still use it to this day. Nonprofit is a tax status, not a business plan. We use that money to provide a foundation from which we operate an incredible array of programs that serve our state. We use it as a foundation for a basis of creating exhibits that bring the newest science before the state of Minnesota and its public, before its students and its teachers. And in our exhibits, we provide and have become one of the largest exhibit sales company in the nonprofit community nationwide. We are the largest distributor of exhibits to other science museums in the nation. We are one of the largest producers of Omni IMAX films in the nation. We distribute films to 400 theaters in 22 countries. We can do that because we have a safe, clean building that can reliably entertain and safely educate our whole community. By building those industries, we support our state being the very first to premiere today the space exhibit and the space movie, originally designated to premiere at the Smithsonian. I should say we're called the world preview of the exhibit. In 9 months, the Smithsonian will have the premiere of our preview. We bring the best to Minnesota through our work. And we use the funds that we can generate by bringing the best to Minnesota to help support our teacher training, our student work. And last year, 40,000 low-income family admissions to the Science Museum of Minnesota. There are many institutions that would like to have that many visitors total. That's how many we give away, because we believe everyone deserves a chance to see this incredible resource. Our teacher training is showing some of the best results in the nation. People have come from all over the United States to learn what we're doing to succeed. We joined with Cargill to start creating engineering education for 3rd through 5th grade and are seeing remarkable results. In fact, each year the state releases the 10 most improved schools by annual yearly progress. That may or may not be the best measure in the world, but it's a measure of which 27 of the last 30 schools announced were Science Museum affiliate schools. We believe we're making a difference. We are one of the few states where the achievement gap is closing. We are going in the right direction, and we're happy to be a part of making that story. Our programming at the Science Museum of Minnesota, if you look at the map on the left side of your booklet, is in all 87 counties. We leave our building and meet our students, our teachers, and our community in their libraries, in their schools, in their senior centers. We've taken $1,079,000 and leveraged it into an annual budget of $42 million. But I have to tell you, without that $1 million, I don't have the foundation to do the work that we do nearly so well. It matters, and we appreciate it, and we hope that the state is proud of the work that we do. We'll continue to work hard. We continue to work hard to preserve our state's assets, not only through the assets of our people and the initiatives that we bring to education, outreach, and community, through exhibits that cause discussion and comments about important civic topics that promote democracy in its fullest extent, but also to preserve the assets of this state in its history. A few years ago, we were privileged to receive legacy funding, and we started to do a great number of things. We started to upgrade through legacy our Omni Theater complex. We started the preservation and maintenance of the Whipple Collection, the American Indian Collection, which is a part of Minnesota's proud heritage. And we started school outreach that allowed us to add more than 25% to our impact in schools. Today, one in every four students visits our museum this year. And we reach many more through our outreach programs. Our legacy appropriation of $1,199,855 is a very exact figure because, quite honestly, we don't pad it. It is down from $2.2 million last year because we told you we had a one-time need that was very great. We're asking for less. Dramatic pause. An aspirin a day is good for your heart. We're asking for less, and with it we're going to do more. We're putting in and we're maintaining a visible lab that shows students how conservation of great objects is managed. We are increasing the circulation of the Whipple Collection and our State American Indian Artifact Collection. We're increasing the use of communities from the Native American, African American, European American, all of our communities to have a voice in the museum in the way in which their culture is displayed. And we're bringing back our race exhibit to return to an important conversation started here in Minnesota that has traveled to the 50 largest cities in the United States and has won more awards than any other museum exhibit in 100 years. Our legacy appropriation is really about the legacy of Minnesota. And so we hope that we've provided the kind of stewardship for these state dollars that they deserve, that we've turned them into the resources that you hope for, and that you are stunned at both the amount that we're able to generate, $42 million this last year, for the base that you give us, and that we reach all of Minnesota and through Minnesota echo across the nation. I'm happy to take questions about our budget, our programs, and our values.
Yeah. The quorum is present. Dr. Jolly, these figures, these total figures on this sheet, is that number of students that you touch, is that what that means, or is that the number of field trips you took, or what is that exactly? It says 80,196 under outreach and 84,829 under field trips.
Those are students who have, through schools, come to the museum under field trips and whom we have reached by going to them in their schools under outreach. It does not count students who come with parents, programs, and youth opportunities. This is simply and strictly school-based formal educational learning, which is only a small portion, 1/6 of our total population of service.
So when you do outreach, you go into a school building and do some kind of a science project with these kids?
We do several different things. Sometimes we will go into a school and do a whole school assembly. While we're doing that whole school assembly, we'll do teacher training and professional development with the teachers. We'll often leave behind an expert trainer for an entire week in the school doing coaching on site. Special classrooms continuously throughout the school year. We will sometimes go into a library and do a program for teachers and teacher training and set up a micro exhibit that schools can visit on site in their county.
So most often we are in the school. Do you blow things up so the kids get real excited? Or
yes, we do.
Okay.
There is little fun in education that happens without a small explosion now and again.
Mr. Chair, you Iron Rangers sure do like blowing things up.
We also bring in trebuchets, so not only can you blow things up, you can send them far away. We don't bring them in large enough to hold teachers or school administrators.
Okay. Senator Westrom.
Well, Mr. Chair, that sounds like a precursor to my fireworks bill.
Very well.
Of which you are a co-author.
Well, maybe there's a place for it in this bill.
Yes. I like your thinking.
Okay. Any questions of Dr. Jolly? Okay.
So I do have
okay.
a question.
Senator Westrom.
On the students, more serious. Doctor, student, your student trips, is there are those admission free on school bus trips or a couple dollars, or what kind of fee do you end up having to charge student groups?
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you for that question. We have a number of different admissions programs. There is usually no fee to our outreach programs, or there's a minimal fee depending on whether we have a sponsor. For example, our oil companies, Flint Hills and others, and our power companies sponsor many of our programs. We are delighted for community support that makes that happen. We have worked with our donor base to put together what we call an angel fund so that we not only subsidize school visits for the cost per student, which is rarely more than $2 per student. So to get to the exact figure, $3 is our top, $2 our average, and sometimes it's free. But we also provide for bus transportation costs. We provide a minimum of $100 for any school that's 50% or more free and reduced lunches. And if the school is more than 100 miles away, we double that. Because one of the greatest expenses to school visitation is transportation. And we have a donor pool that allows us to do that. Last year, we spent nearly $40,000 in school subsidies for buses and students.
Okay. Mr. Severson, you want to add anything?
I'm here in support of Dr. Jolly, but yes, we're very proud of the work that we do, and thank you for your support.
Okay. Any other questions? So you're asking for less? Is that what you said?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Okay. Of what? Legacy money, though?
Of MET legacy money and flat for our state annual appropriation.
Okay. All right. And what does the legacy money go for?
Legacy money supports our American Indian collection, artifact preservation, display, and circulation, our school programming for outreach across the state, and community support for the race exhibit and community-based discussions on citizenship at the museum using our artifacts to teach.
Okay. All right. Any other questions of Dr. Jolly? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Enjoy the rattleback, and I'll be glad to do the very simple math lesson anytime.
All right, well, if you happen to stop by my office, be prepared, okay?
All right. I will. All right,
okay. Okay, Department of Economic Development, Employment Economic Development. Deed. Just say your name for the record and then go ahead and start.
I'm Kevin McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Economic Development at Deed.
How's the Commissioner doing?
She's doing very well.
Yeah, okay, she's still on her...
Mr. Chair, I'm Jeremy Hansen-Willis, also Deputy Commissioner at Deed.
She's still on her left side or is she on her right side? No.
We believe she's on her left side.
Okay, all right. When's she due?
She's
any
actually...
Day.
When?
Any day.
Any day. Okay, good luck. All right. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for inviting Deed here today to present to you our budget. As we indicated, our Commissioner Clark Sieben sends her regrets that she is not able to be with us today. She is on doctor's order bed rest and is due any day, so she is telecommuting and in contact with us regularly, so we are filling in for her today. As you know, DEED is the state's principal economic development agency. We have over 1,500 dedicated staff statewide, all working toward one goal, and that is to enhance the economic success of individuals, businesses, and communities. Today, we'll give you an overview of many DEED programs that help us in that mission. We'll also provide you some details on the governor's recommendations for all of our programs here at DEED. Our work falls into three primary work groups, workforce development, economic development, and operations. Our operations includes all our administrative, fiscal, and human resources areas. Our economic development includes broadband, business community development, and trade. And our workforce development area includes our workforce development division, unemployment, vocational rehab, workforce development, Governor's Workforce Development Council, and many others. We also oversee the work of two independent agencies, the Public Facilities Authority and Minnesota Tourism. I'm going to start with the economic development side here. We work every day to make sure that Minnesota is a place where business can thrive and grow. Our business assistance area provides a variety of tools to businesses, including technical assistance on startups and managing a business, as well as financial resources. Our trade office is focused on a critical piece of the state's economy, exports and foreign direct investment, and our community assistance programs, which include our Office of Broadband Development, provide the infrastructure necessary for communities to be successful. As I'll reiterate several times throughout this portion of the presentation, everything that we do is in partnership with city and county governments, nonprofit development entities, and a wide variety of stakeholders. We could not possibly reach all the businesses or communities that we would need to help otherwise. Likewise, our local partners often rely upon us for the use of state programs to make sure business development deals happen. Minnesota Trade Office. This office promotes the economic prosperity by increasing the state's exports and foreign direct investments. Exports of manufactured goods, services, and agricultural commodities to foreign countries are an extremely important part of Minnesota's economy, accounting for over $33 billion in revenue annually and tens of thousands of jobs statewide. We know these goods are worth more on the global market. We know that they require more skills to make, thus they equal higher wages, thus increasing the new money that's brought into the state. By providing the training and other resources that small and mid-sized companies need, become successful exporters of goods and services, we help companies turn opportunities into profits in foreign markets across the globe. The STEP program, which is our largest program in this area, provides financial and technical assistance to small businesses to help lower the costs of entering new foreign markets. We also maintain offices in key international markets, one in China, and last year, over the past couple of years, thanks to the governor and legislature, we have opened up three new office locations, one in Brazil, one in Germany, and one in South Korea. Though they've only recently launched these offices, they are working to tell our story, open new markets for Minnesota businesses, and help companies explore opportunities for investments in Minnesota. The governor's budget continues these key investments from 2013, ensuring that we can keep this work moving forward into the next biennium. A business assistance overview. Our Business Community Development Division provides financial and technical services to businesses, communities, and economic development professionals to support the creation, expansion, attraction, and retention of businesses. Within this part of the agency, we have several offices with distinct functions. Some of you may know the DEED business development representatives in your area. We have staff located throughout the state that work closely with companies, local governments, and other development organizations on all type of business issues. We also operate the Small Business Assistance Office, which provides resources and counseling, consulting services to tens of thousands of current and aspiring business owners each year, and our Small Business Development Center program, which is a network of regional centers in concert with higher education institutions, provide technical assistance to businesses in communities across the state. We are also responsible for the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership, which works with the higher education institution, accredited higher education institutions, to offer customized training assistance to employers across the state. Finally, our business finance office runs tax benefit, grant, and loan programs that help companies and communities retain jobs and add new ones. Among these programs, our Angel Tax Credit program is one that you're most likely familiar with. This provides a 25% credit to investors or investment funds that put money into startup companies focused on high technology or processes or services in specific fields. As members of this legislature have occasionally pointed out, this program funds a fair number of businesses in the metro. That said, we've seen increasing numbers of businesses from the metro later begin manufacturing operations in Greater Minnesota. We've also seen some fantastic Greater Minnesota startups taking advantage of this program. For example, AgriStand in Mankato that manufactures environmentally products, friendly products in use in the construction trade, Bioplastic Solutions in Blooming Prairie and manufactures a variety of bio-based and biocomposite products, and of course Mill Creek Life Sciences out of Rochester that produces commercial human and protein-based cell cultures to help develop new therapies. The Angel Tax Credit Program is funded for 2015 and 2016 at $15 million per year, half of which is allocated to Greater Minnesota minorities and women. Those funds are available until September 30th, at which time they become available in the statewide pool. Other tax benefit programs that we administer include the Greater Minnesota Job Expansion Program, the Border City Tax Credit Program, and finally, our grant and loan incentive programs for businesses are some of the most well-known. These include a number of financing programs such as our Urban Initiative Program, our Innovation Voucher Program, Veteran Loan Program, and some of the programs that we've developed through our federally funded State Small Business Credit Initiative Program, such as the Angel Loan Fund and the Emerging Entrepreneur Fund, most of which we run through a lot of our nonprofit partners across the state. While these targeted programs are important, I'd like to point out the Minnesota Investment Fund and the Job Creation Fund are our two primary tools to attract businesses to Minnesota, but also to help our existing businesses expand. Our Minnesota Investment Fund dollars are distributed to local governments who then provide loans to the businesses to support capital investment and job creation. We've made about $15 million worth of loans in this biennium thus far, leveraging $415 million in private investment and been part of creating nearly 2,000 new jobs. Of these projects, we've done 41 to date. 22 are in Greater Minnesota, and 19 of which have been in the Twin Cities. The Minnesota Job Creation Fund allows companies to receive financial incentives if, and only if, they create at least 10 full-time positions and invest at least $500,000 in real property improvements. This program has two types of incentives, job creation awards and capital investment rebates. Depending on these factors, up to $1 million is generally available based on the individual actual investment and job creation. This program has awarded about $14 million this biennium so far, leveraging $251 million in capital investment and helped to create over 1,300 new jobs. Of the 27 projects to date, 14 have been in Greater Minnesota. It's important to note that even though we've made some significant investments in economic development over the past couple of years, our programs do remain modest compared with those offered by many other states, including those surrounding us. We are incredibly grateful for these resources. We have, however, because they give us a seat at the table and an opportunity to highlight the many advantages of doing business in Minnesota. These programs are conservative relative to other states, as I've mentioned, but they are also responsible. We employ caps that limit the amount of the awards, and we require performance in order to receive the benefits.
What are the caps?
$1 million in the Job Creation Fund and $1 million in the Minnesota Investment Fund.
And then does the business have to match it?
The business, of course, has to match it, yes.
Okay. And which one is the 10? Is this the one with 10 jobs minimum, or...?
Job Creation Fund is 10 jobs minimum.
Okay. All right.
Given the strong results we've seen from those programs, Governor Dayton's budget continues the base appropriations, including $25 million for the Job Creation Fund and $30 million for the Minnesota Investment Fund. As you review these programs, I'd like to take a moment just to highlight a few additional points about these programs and how they contribute to Minnesota's economic growth. First, while there's a perception that these programs are often benefiting large corporations, that's simply not the case. As long as they meet job creation and investment requirements, there are no size limitations as far as the business that can participate in these programs. We've had a number of awards in the current biennium from both programs that have gone to smaller businesses, such as Ice Castle Fish Houses in Cass County, Harmony Enterprises in Harmony, Lewis Industries in Painesville, Herbix in Brooklyn Park. I also need to make it clear that about 85% of our resources do go to existing businesses, while only about 15% of our resources go to attracting new business to Minnesota. Second, while many of these finance programs benefit Main Street businesses, the Minnesota Investment Fund and the Job Creation Fund are two programs that are uniquely focused on particularly industry sectors where we know they can bring the biggest return to Minnesota for our investments. Manufacturing, call center, distribution center, data center, or corporate relocations are examples of facilities that can be used or that can be based in a number of different states and all serve the same customers. On the contrary, local service providers like hospitals, clinics, other retailers need to locate in the local market to meet the demand and do not have those types of location options. Assisting projects in the first category, such as expansion of manufacturing and so on, is important because these businesses have a variety of worldwide locations to consider. And when site location attributes and assets are similar, incentives obviously are often play a key role in influencing where companies grow jobs and make investments. Second, these programs do bring new money into the state that would otherwise have gone elsewhere. That in turn recirculates through the Minnesota economy to other construction firms, to suppliers of the firms that are here, to retailers through indirect spending of employees and so on. That's why we feel it's critical to continue these investments. And these programs don't just help the businesses that we're assisting directly, they help the entire state's economy grow. One additional item that I would like to mention that you'll notice in the governor's budget is a clarification of Deed's authorization to expend application fees collected under the Greater Minnesota Job Expansion Program. The current language allows Deed to impose and collect an application fee for certifying qualified small businesses and states that funds may be used to defray the commissioner's costs of processing certifications. Though the legislative intent was for those fees to be available for our administrative purposes, the law does not explicitly give the agency the authority to expend that revenue collected. Without these fees, Deed will not have the adequate resources to manage this program in the coming biennium. As such, the change is recommended by the governor. And essentially, it would deposit fees into a Deed special revenue account that we could use.
Senator Sparks.
Can you tell us how much is the fee?
The fee, Mr. Chair, is the fee is $500 or 10% of the award.
Thank you.
And then we have what? We have a 3% holdback? Is it a 3% administrative fee? Is that what's in the law?
No, Mr. Chair, it's an application fee that the businesses who are applying to us must pay.
Right.
So it's $500 or 10% of their award.
Okay, but isn't there also a 3%?
Not on the Greater Minnesota Job Expansion Program.
Okay.
There's
all right.
Not. Community assistance side of our economic development.
Oh, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we get off that subject, I just wanted to ask, when you say there's a minimum of, I think it was 10 jobs, how long of a time period do you check to see if those 10 jobs actually stayed there? I mean, is it like 2 years or 5 years?
Mr. Chair, members, it depends on the term of the agreement. In Greater Minnesota, we go up to 7 years. With the Job Creation Fund is what you're referencing, and in the Twin Cities we go up to 5 years, so they must maintain the jobs that long in order to get the rebates on the jobs that they've created.
Okay.
Community assistance. We know that communities need many things to attract and keep businesses, jobs, and people, such as sound housing, ample commercial and industrial property, healthy drinking water, water treatment, solid infrastructure, and so on. These resources don't often come cheap. To help communities stay vital and competitive for potential economic opportunities, we provide financial assistance for a variety of development needs. Community assistance programs such as our redevelopment grant program, which helps with the costs of redeveloping blighted industrial, residential, and commercial sites, and putting that land back into productive use, or our contamination cleanup and investigation programs grant program, which helps pay for assessing and cleaning contaminated sites for public or private investment following the cleanup. We also operate several infrastructure programs, such as the Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Program, the Innovative Business Development Public Infrastructure Program, and the Transportation Economic Development Program in partnership with MnDOT to support communities, specifically to support new economic development projects.
Now, do communities have to apply for all of these different grants that you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, they do.
And how do we get the information out to them that these things are available?
We can certainly provide you those contacts and the application forms. Most are based on a first-come, first-serve basis, or some are competitive where they have two or three rounds a year. Our staff are constantly in communication with cities across the state, do workshops regularly on how to apply, but we'd be happy to make sure that that information gets out.
I would be happy if you would make sure the information gets out, but is the information getting out? You named about five or six different programs just now, and I'm just concerned that maybe some cities know about it and some don't. Are you contacting everybody is what I'm wondering.
Mr. Chair, we make every effort to do so through economic development associations and different workshops and things that we host, but of course we could always do a better job of that, and we'll certainly try to do that.
Well, but isn't there just a push a button and send emails to all the cities and let them know that these things are available, and then they have to pick up on it? Are you not doing that?
We are doing that through our gov delivery system that maybe you're all on, that you get maybe too often from us, but we do try to communicate that as regularly as possible.
But it just doesn't come to us, it goes to cities also, right?
We have about 70,000 people on that.
All right, okay.
Mail list. We are also at DEED responsible for a large number of public projects passed by the legislature and the governor. At present, we have about $180 million in different bonding projects and things that we are managing across the state. More recently, our Office of Broadband has focused on the critical role that broadband plays for communities and economic development. Last year, the legislature and the governor have obviously been supportive of this and allocated $20 million to this program, for which we received 40 applications with $44 million of requests and about $99 million of eligible costs. We recently awarded $19.4 million to 17 projects across the state that leveraged an additional $25 million in capital investment, for a total of over $45 million in project costs that will serve 6,100 households, 83 community institutions, and hundreds of businesses. In the governor's budget, we are recommending another $30 million for this program for the next biennium. Based on some goals that policymakers made back in 2010, one was to achieve border-to-border access to moderate levels of broadband service to every home in the state by 2015, and also to achieve a top ranking among states in the adoption and use of broadband technologies. At present, about 75% of households across the state have access to broadband at or above state speed goals. That leaves about 300,000 households that still need such service. Given the importance of broadband access to businesses of all size and to the communities that they locate in, we are recommending $30 million in funding that would be available in the next biennium. It would also be awarded on the same competitive grant process that we started this past session in the inaugural grant round. To date, we know that there are varying numbers of estimates of how much money this would take to achieve these goals. Estimates are between $900 million and $3.2 billion. The state of Minnesota is just one of many contributors towards closing that gap. Providers, namely, will continue to go into underserved and unserved areas where they can achieve the strongest returns on their investment. This
Senator,
funding,
Senator Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. McKinnon. I just had a quick question just to clarify. My understanding is the governor's recommendation is $30 million for fiscal year 2016 for round two, and that the recommendation is silent on what that funding recommendation would be for 2017, which would be round three of the fund. Is that correct?
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The $30 million would be available in the first year of the biennium.
Sure.
If it's not all spent in that first year, we would obviously have it for a future grant round as well.
And, you know, maybe you could help me here, Senator Schmidt, because it seems to me when we did that press conference for rural Minnesota, you made some kind of a comment about 450,000 houses not getting broadband, don't have broadband access or something like that. And then Minnesota Public Radio did some kind of a accuracy check on it and said the deed said that everybody's got broadband. And you just said there's 300,000 that don't have broadband. So what's the real numbers here?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I recall, I think we were both mentioned in that piece by
NPR. I'm not trying to criticize
but,
you.
I'm
trying to find out what the real number is, because I thought NPR got their numbers from deed and they said that everybody has it. And so I want to find out if – and he just said 300,000 don't have it.
Right.
And so I'm trying to find out what that report was all about and what the real numbers are.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think your question's a great one, and I think that there's a lot of, I guess, different interpretations on what is broadband, and I think that's at the heart of that question. The way we've talked about this issue at the legislature the last couple of years is fixed, you know, wired broadband. And we've always focused on the end user experience, what you would use broadband for, you know, for telehealth, for starting businesses, telecommuting, you know, flip schedules with distance learning, that sort of thing. And in many cases, that utilization of broadband requires hardwired service. And so in that case, what we've learned from the governor's task force on broadband and others is that upwards of 20% of Minnesota households lack access to that wired service. And so I think the number that we shared with the press on that day was 450,000 Minnesota households, about 20%. Obviously, we're gonna see some gains in that area, and hopefully that number shrinks over time. But in my estimation, the magnitude of the problem is about 20% of Minnesota households lack access to that wired service. And so I think we have a very significant problem out there.
I was agreeing with you. I just want to find out where Minnesota Public Radio got their numbers, because I thought they said they got them from deed, and I thought they said that everybody's got it. And now I just heard Mr. McKinnon say that 300,000 don't have it.
Right.
So what's going on here? Can you kind of shed some light on that for me, please?
Mr. Chair, I'm not exactly sure of what that number is, but I do have Dana McKenzie here, who runs our broadband program.
Senator Schmidt, go ahead.
I was just going to say I would defer to, you know, Ms. McKenzie if she has an opportunity.
Ms. McKenzie, do you know the answer to my question? Because I'm pretty sure not everybody doesn't have broadband, so otherwise we wouldn't be doing this. Ms. McKenzie, thank you. Just say your name for the record.
Chair, my name is Dana McKenzie, and I'm Executive Director of the Office of Broadband Development. And I believe the number that NPR was referring to in that particular piece was a lower definition of broadband. The number that we've been using both at DEED as well as the legislative discussions that have happened to this point are referring specifically to broadband connections that meet that standard that we set in 2000, that was set in 2010 in legislation, and that's the 10. I don't believe NPR was specific about the speed, but they were looking at some of the information from Connect Minnesota that indicated that almost everyone in the state had access to something that didn't meet any of the standards that we have set.
Okay, that makes it clear. Okay. Senator Dibble.
Just so we all know, what is 10-5?
It's not a bowling average, so go ahead. Dana, go ahead and explain that.
I apologize. I missed the question.
Oh, what is 10-5?
Minnesota, in 2010, there was a legislative standard set a goal for 10 megabits per second download and 5 megabits per second upload as a moderate level of internet access that we were setting as our goal for statewide access.
Right. Jargon just isn't a good thing to use.
Yes.
Public
then,
testimony. Public is listening.
And then what did the feds just come out with some kind of a revision of their speeds?
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, they did, and they just revised. Our legislation is currently keyed to the definition that was in place at the time of that writing, which was 4 megabits per second down and 1 megabit per second up. The FCC just recently modified that standard to 25 megabits down and 3 megabits per second up. Oddly, Minnesota is actually the 25 megabits down, 3 up. We actually have a little bit higher coverage of than we do of state standards because of the challenge in meeting the upload aspect of our goal, which is really targeted at the Minnesotans being contributors to the content on the internet and not just consumers, and really looking at the economic development potential of the network that we're funding.
Senator Dibble.
I had a question about round one. If I can jump to that.
Senator Westrum, is your question to Ms. McKenzie? Or
it does.
Okay. Can he go first then? Okay, Senator Westrum.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Ms. McKenzie, you talk about the changing standards, and when we deploy these grants and the internet across the state, what are we building to? And I think you see where I'm going with my question, but you know, if the feds just changed it, and we perhaps would have been building to the 10 up, 1 down, or whatever, 10 down, 1 up speed. I mean, at some point, we're going to just change the regulations and put ourselves out of, quote, broadband deployed everywhere in the state because we won't meet the standards. It's kind of like what the cities feel when the PCA keeps changing their permit standards. So I'm just wondering, how do we guard against that and wiring in technology, or is everything they're putting in fiber so they can get as fast as we're going to ever need to get? It's just a matter of turning up more speed.
Sure, members. I believe your concern was addressed somewhat in the original legislation, in that the technology itself wasn't specified. It was really the target of what it's capable of doing. So any state funding isn't going to fund just a 10-1 or a 10 megabits connection or a 4 megabits connection. It actually needs to be capable of delivering a 100 megabit connection, which is really kind of looking out a few years. You know, we're kind of trying to look at where the puck is headed as far as any state investments that are going in. But also the idea that what's in place and what is currently in play is there measured strategic investments in a field that we know will continue to evolve. It won't be a one and done thing. It's going to continue to evolve. So we're making the investments with the best information we have available to us right now. And part of our office is dedicated towards the research and the tracking of that. And I know the wireless question comes up regularly, and while wireless applications that we've received have not been able to clearly demonstrate that we're going to get that bang for the state's investment yet, we see it happening. We see it coming. And so the next time I come and talk to you next year, we will likely have a different conversation about which technologies are currently meeting the standards that have been set. I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I'm not sure if Mr. McKinnon was going to give us a quick high-level overview of round one, how much went out in the form of grants, and got for that, and who it went to, and what the demand was, if we could get those,
is that Ms.
a sense of how round one went quickly.
I'd bet Ms. McKenzie knows that stuff.
Or Ms. McKenzie.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I wasn't going to give you that other than the $19.4 million and the 17 projects. I'm not sure.
How much detail do you want, Senator Dibble?
Well, that's pretty good. And what did they go for, and how much, how what was the total dollar amount of all the requests made?
Okay. Ms. McKenzie, do you know that?
I do know that.
Mr. Chair, members, I happen to have a set of handouts from my morning presentation that included the list of awardees, the map, and all the numbers, and I believe I have enough for the committee if that's something that would be helpful to you.
Sure.
That would have those details.
That would probably, is that what you're looking for, Senator Dibble?
And I'm also interested in knowing how much came in the form of requests.
Who knows that?
That was, Mr. Chair, that was $44 million in requests. And there was about almost $99 million, $100 million in eligible project costs.
Thank you.
What does that mean exactly?
We can only be 50% of the total project cost.
And so $44 million in requests and $99 million in project costs. $44 million means that people applied for $44 million worth of broadband projects, but there was another $99 million on top of that would have to be funded?
No, Mr. Chair, the total project costs were about $100 million, and they were asking for $44 million from us.
All right. Okay. Senator Schmidt.
And question for Ms. McKenzie. If you could just speak to the federal funding opportunity, or at least the letter of interest process that played out last year, and what Minnesota's response was to that in terms of dollar amounts requested, just to speak to the level of interest that we think is out there in greater Minnesota for broadband infrastructure improvements.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Schmidt is referring to a tool that we used last year to get a sense of what the level of demand was going to be. At that timing was right that the federal government requested a letter of interest from any nationwide to serve rural parts of the state, and in order to inform their process for what they term a rural broadband experiments and what they might expect for applications to that program. Minnesota had more responses than any other state in the union, and I'm trying to think. It was in 60. It was approximately 60 letters. Those requests constituted approximately $600 million in project value, and so that gave us a sense of the type of projects that are out there at this stage of the game. And we are continuing our dialogue with providers and communities, and those speculative numbers have been proven out in our dialogue over the last year with those providers.
Thank you, Ms. McKenzie. It's my understanding that there's a lot of potential applicants and dollars to be requested, kind of sitting on the sidelines for round one. Is it your understanding too that there's a lot of applicants waiting for funding for rounds two and three?
McKenzie.
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, it is our sense, but I have to be fair and say it's anecdotal. We don't have a tool in place where we've gathered that information at this stage. All I can tell you is, again, I spoke to a room of 45 people who were representing communities that were hoping for good news from this process that did not step up, so they aren't represented in the list of the 40 applications that we've already seen.
So, Ms. McKenzie, were you a hockey player?
Mr. Chair, no, I wasn't.
Okay. The Gretzky reference was what I was wondering about. So anyway, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, Wayne Gretzky said he didn't go where the puck is. He goes where the puck is going to be. Okay. So anyway. Okay. Any more questions for Ms. McKenzie? If you got a handout, maybe we can get a page over here and he can get the handout and hand it out to the committee members. So, okay, Mr. McKinnon, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do appreciate your continued efforts in the months ahead. And unless there's any other questions on economic development, I would turn it over now to my colleague Jeremy Hansen-Willis to talk about our workforce development recommendations in the governor's budget.
Who can explain these things? Like what is the NAICS code?
North American. Mr. Chair, that's the North American Classification Industrial Classification Code. I believe you're looking at your district profiles.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how the key industry in my district is the transportation equipment manufacturing.
Mr. Chair, that would have to depend on how the businesses in your region are classified and what they classify themselves as.
That's why, Mr. Chair, that's why we have you on my committee.
But, well, good, because I didn't know we did transportation equipment manufacturing, but other than some big, big things that they put together up there for the mining companies. But,
well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Osborne.
Mine is support activities for transportation. I'll be darned if I can figure that one out.
Maybe we've got to find out.
We have Senator Osmink on our committee.
How about you, Senator Dibble? What's yours?
I was looking for my sheet. I think it's coffee shops and.
So, Mr. Chair, that explains why he's the chair.
So you and I are getting all the people to go over to his coffee shop somehow. That must
right.
Be what it is. Okay. All right. Go ahead, Mr. Willis. Go ahead.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, members, I think we all know that a central component to a strong economy and a competitive economy is having a skilled workforce that helps families to be economically sustainable and helps to meet the needs of Minnesota businesses. DEED has a number of programs that work to connect employers to workers of all skills and backgrounds, including adults from communities of color, long-term unemployment, unemployed adults, youth, and individuals with disabilities. We operate Minnesota's unemployment insurance program to ensure that workers, employers, and communities are able to withstand periods of economic downturn or the loss of employment. Our vocational rehabilitation services help people with disabilities to achieve their goals and develop work skills, find suitable work, and advance in their careers. And our Workforce Development Division operates a variety of programs that help both adults and young people work towards greater economic success. I'll be talking about these programs in more detail in the time I have today. The first is unemployment insurance. And particularly during recessions that we just experienced, one of the most critical tools to keeping Minnesota's economy strong is the unemployment insurance program. This program provides stability to local economies by helping people to maintain spending during economic downturns. It supports dislocated workers while they obtain training so that they can re-enter the labor market. And it ensures that skilled workers do not leave our Minnesota communities in search of other work elsewhere during periods of short-term unemployment. And as an example, in 2014, about $827 million in unemployment benefits were paid to more than 178,000 Minnesotans. The governor's recommendation in this area of unemployment insurance is based upon the recommendation of our Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, and it proposes several federal conformity, policy, and technical changes to the unemployment insurance program statutes. These changes will strengthen the unemployment insurance program, clarify and simplify statutory provisions, and eliminate update unnecessary, outdated, and confusing language. As some of these committee members know here today, you know firsthand the service of our UI Advisory Council. That is a nonpartisan group of stakeholders, including legislators from both parties, business interests, labor unions, and others that meet annually to discuss the issues facing the unemployment insurance program. And the recommendations included in Governor Dayton's budget have all been thoroughly discussed by that group and endorsed by its members. These provisions are included in the budget because they may have fiscal impact on the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Now, that trust fund is maintained outside the state treasury, and this bill will have no impact on state funds. Committee members can also expect to see this as a standalone bill in the weeks to come, so you'll have more opportunity to get more detailed information about those technical and policy recommendations. Next is our adult workforce development programs, which support Minnesotans to seek new employment through many local and statewide partnerships designed to develop and improve career skills and obtain employment at family-sustaining wages. We serve a variety of populations through these programs, including the general customer population, veterans, recently laid off workers, and low-wage and low-skill adults. In our 48 workforce centers across the state, a significant portion of our federal funding goes towards these general customers who seek simply greater participation in the labor force. In 2014, more than 473,000 people used our Minnesota workforce centers. We also administer federally funded programs that provide job readiness assessments, job preparation, and placement assistance to veterans. And in 2014, 5,564 veterans were served by these programs. DEED also helps workers who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own to receive assistance in finding a new job or career. The Dislocated Worker Program, which is funded with both state and federal money, helps laid-off workers to return to a job with comparable wages and benefits or higher. In addition, participants can access career planning, counseling, job search, and placement services, short-term training, and support services for things like family care and transportation. And in 2014, 87% of these folks re-entered employment through the Dislocated Worker Program.
Excuse me a second. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question, and I'm going to vent here for a minute. Could you explain the Dislocated Workers Program? As background, I had about 150 constituents that worked for a company that they were, quote, laid off. So I called Deed, was told, oh, yes, the dislocated worker program could help. I can give you exact specifics of when I talked to. I didn't talk to you. But I thought the process was moving along, and then about a month later talked to my council member's office, only to find out, well, no, they weren't technically employees. They were independent contractors, and so they didn't qualify under the dislocated workers program. But then about a month later, I get a email where you're soliciting requests for qualifications for a program, and it says the dislocated workers program and individuals could have been self-employed. And so there was a disconnect because this is for people who, you know, may have been self-employed. I did have a conversation at the time then with Deed to say, well, did you check with Dolly? Because it's a different situation. But, again, I think they should have been employees and not contractors, because then, you know, they weren't paying, you know, the company was getting around not paying that unemployment insurance and all sorts of other things. But if you could just clarify what a dislocated worker is and who qualifies for those funds, that would be helpful.
Mr. Willis.
Mr. Chair, members, what I would like to do to be accurate and also maybe to speak to the specific case, we actually have the director of our dislocated program with us today, Anthony Alangi. Mr. Alangi, if you would come up briefly and help to provide this level of detail and may even know something about this
Thank
example.
You.
Yep. Mm-hmm. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, the
please,
chair, so I can
please,
contact.
Please do.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Anthony Alangi. I'm the director of the Dislocated Worker Program at the State of Minnesota. I do have a recollection of this exact case, and I believe I can speak to it without using the name of the company since the senator avoided it as well. This is a company, to the best of my knowledge, that operated with many contractors rather than with employees. The eligibility is not in question. The ability to reach these individuals after the company closed its doors is what is in question. So what ended up happening was our rapid response staff happens to be a Somali-American and established a good working relationship with the owner of the company, did attempt to get a list of those employees who were laid off, was told they're not employees, they're subcontractors, asked for a list of those individuals, and was told that that was not available because they're independent contractors. It makes it difficult to reach out to folks who are being impacted by any layoff event when we don't get cooperation from the company in question. So while some of these folks may very well have been eligible and may still, in fact, be eligible, our ability to reach out to them and force the issue with a company that has closed its doors does make it difficult. But that would be something that people could come to a workforce center if impacted, and we do have word out to the best of our ability through the community to that effect.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that. That there was some miscommunication then, because that's not what I heard and that's not what the council member's office heard, and I believe that we could set up a meeting with some of the people if they are still interested, so I will follow up with both of you again to do that, because this is a area of, so the metropolitan area has about a 3.3% unemployment rate is what I keep reading, which is fabulous, we like that, but this pocket of the community could be as high as 30% unemployment, and so I think anything that we can do and to help get them employed, especially when they want to work and they are eligible to work, I think would be helpful. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have Target?
Okay. Mr. Hanson. Mr. Willis. Hanson Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And as Senator Dietzick just alluded to, I think it's useful to have a little bit of the context of the economic environment in which we're working in right now, in particular as I talk about the next set of programs in which is a priority for us. But as you know, the overall state unemployment rate in Minnesota is extremely low right now at around 4 to 3% around the state. But that unemployment is not being experienced evenly through all parts of the state and in all communities. And while Minnesota has the third highest labor force participation of any state in the country, we know that some of these experiences are not being felt evenly. Which is why currently today and as we go into the future, it's increasingly important for DEED and the workforce development programs that we administer be targeted to these populations with greater barriers to employment. who tend to be more of the low income, low skill, and low unemployment, including communities of color and immigrants, which is why there are two programs that we have in existence today that specifically target these populations, and it also relates to the governor's proposal in this area as well. Our state-funded Minnesota Fast Track Career Pathways Program provides basic skills education and career-specific training in fields where new skills are in high demand by employers. And again, this program specifically targets low education, low-skilled members of the state to help them get credentials and employment. And in 2014, more than 1,000 people were reached by these programs through competitive grants, and 88% completed coursework, which is a very high number given the populations that we're talking about. Similarly, the state-funded Adult Workforce Development Competitive Grant Program works with a statewide network of local community-based providers to offer employment and training assistance to individuals living with disabilities who are deaf, hard of hearing, individuals returning to work after receiving public assistance or incarceration, and are racial and ethnic minorities. Again, many of these populations with barriers to employment. And in 2014, 64% of these folks entered employment from these programs, and 92% retained that employment in 90 days. And especially in recognition of the changing dynamics we have in Minnesota right now, where our baby boomers are retiring and leading us with an ever-looming and growing labor shortage that we face as a result, these programs are as vital and needed as ever. And we need to make sure that all Minnesotans are able to find meaningful work and to meet the needs of our growing businesses and economy. Which is why in the governor's budget, the most significant workforce development legislative proposal we are offering is aimed at providing even better services to these populations of adults facing barriers to employment at a time that we need them as much as ever. While the Fast Track and the Adult Workforce Competitive Grant programs have shown very strong results for these low-wage, low-skill adults that they serve, Governor Dayton is pushing agencies, including DEED, to work harder and smarter within our existing resources. And to that end, the governor's budget recommends the creation of a new, single, competitively awarded career pathways program called the Pathways to Prosperity Program. As with these existing programs, Pathways to Prosperity would focus on providing services to adults with barriers to employment.
This is on page 11 in the budget book if you want to read about this. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Pages 10 and 11 in the budget book goes into greater detail about this program. Key components of this new Pathways to Prosperity program would include remedial education, skill-based and credential training, placement and retention in jobs that pay enough wages to sustain families, and a focus on the exact industries that need training and success measured by clear employment outcomes. With combined funding from these two existing programs and $2.5 million in redirected funds from the Workforce Development Fund, this new program would receive a total appropriation of just over $12 million. And again, this recommendation uses existing funds, requiring no new general fund dollars to create and implement this program. By integrating the best elements in evidence-based practices and merging these funding streams of the two programs into one, we believe that we can better reflect the common mission and goals and make resources available to nonprofit community-based service providers and customers more effectively and address the needs that are going unmet by our highly restrictive federal funding, which also attempts to receive to help these populations. Mr. Chair, I think there's a question.
Senator Dietzer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you for all that your work you're doing on this. I think this is, like you said, there are pockets that are not, they're just not reaching it, which kind of makes me nervous because we're supposed to be on the upswing, and that downswing might be coming again, and when there are areas where there's 30% unemployment still, it makes me really nervous. Are any of these in the new Pathways to Prosperity, are you doing any paper performance measures, or what type of goals are you attaching to these other than just moving people through? And then is there a retention? You mentioned 90-day retention, and so what is that? Because it, in some ways it doesn't help to just get somebody in the door. I'd like to make sure they stay in the door and stay on that job or a job.
Mr. Wills.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzek, As a new program, we have not yet finished all the details on the goals and objectives and how the request for proposals would look and what we would expect. But based on our experience with some other programs, I think you're exactly right, that the attainment of employment at family-sustaining wages, the retention of that employment, acquiring industry-recognized credentials or higher education certificates are the kind of things that we look for in terms of program outcomes. And we especially look for that among the target populations to ensure that we're reaching the diversity of our communities of color, another low-skill, low-education part of our workforce.
So this program, you're basically taking all the dollars from all the competitive grant programs and putting them into a new competitive grant program? Is that what we're doing here?
Mr. Chair, we're proposing to take the funding from these two programs. There are other programs that receive direct appropriations in the Workforce Development Fund, and we don't take the money from that. It's just from the Fast Track program, the Adult Workforce Competitive Program, and $2.5 million from Dislocated Worker Program.
And which are the other programs that you're not taking the money from, are those competitive grant programs, or are they just direct appropriations to a particular program?
Mr. Chair, those are direct appropriations.
Okay. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. I have one more follow-up. So you mentioned that to get the people required, you know, to get them some certification or something to move on, and I appreciate that because one of my companies in my district was just advertising. They have a machinist job, and I know those are a lot more high-skilled than they maybe used to be, and so getting the people to get the certification to do that job when there's jobs out there that are empty is great. But what do you do with the population that is not – probably not quite ready yet to get that certification? They might be a step back, and so, I mean, they need those soft skills. How do you, but I think that's valuable to get those people ready so that they can get to that next level to get to that good job. Do any of these programs help them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, you have hit the nail on the head for why the Pathways to Prosperity program is being developed. It is based on a philosophy called Career Pathways, which Minnesota has used extensively in our Fast Track program and is one that's taking hold widely around the country. And some of the core components of Career Pathways model is that it's industry focused. So it's meeting the specific demands of industry right now. It's not just training people for any old job, but training them in jobs that we know are in demand right now. But one of the unique aspects of a Career Pathways model is not just providing the credentials or the training to get a specific job, that for these populations in particular, they need support services, almost case management kind of wraparound services. They maybe need ESL education or adult basic education, or as you say, soft skills, foundational skills training. So what a Career Pathways model would do, which we're proposing in this new program, would use this model to provide these kind of wraparound services. So as someone's going through a credential program or a training program to get a career that they know is waiting for them, they're getting those kind of wraparound services. It could be transportation, it could be childcare, it could be counseling to make the right decisions. That's a key component of this program.
So is everything you just explained the difference between these competitive grant programs and the ones that we had before? Is everybody who applied for the competitive grant programs before going to be eligible for this new program, or is it something different, or what? I suppose anybody can apply, depending on what. So we changed the criteria, I guess I should say, for how you get this money.
Mr. Chair, again, while we're still working on developing the criteria, my guess would be that any of the organizations that received competitive grant funding previously through the two existing programs would be perfect opportunities for them to apply for this program. Many of the same community-based organizations that have been doing this kind of work, especially with the Fast Track model, which is the closest thing to the new program that we're proposing. So I think many, if not all, of those organizations which have received funding from us would be good candidates. In addition, though, we're doing a lot of work to continue increasing and expanding the outreach to more communities, especially communities of color. And we have been partnering with community-based organizations around the state to make sure that more organizations, especially those that serve these populations, are aware of our funding, know how to compete for the funding, and can successfully do so, so that we make sure that the program reaches the diversity of the population in our state.
So is there a preconceived notion about who might not qualify now? Or don't we know that? I suppose it would be based on the application. Is that
Mr. Chair, again, it's tough to know at this time because in a competitive grant program, you partly are based upon who applies. But in addition to, you know, providing the goals of the program, we look for things like a fiscal ability, that an organization has the capacity to manage a grant and the funds of this kind. We look at track record of their ability to do so. We look at relationship that they have in the community and their ability to serve these populations in different settings.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Now, Mr. Chair, we mentioned the dislocated worker program, and one other proposal in the governor's budget recognizes the importance of skills enhancement among our current employees or our incumbent workers. And while dislocated workers will always be a priority for DEED and funding would be preserved for those in need during periods of high employment, making also incumbent worker training an allowable use under our dislocated worker fund will help strengthen the state's workforce during periods of economic growth. Thousands of Minnesotans could benefit from the chance to enhance their skills on the job and advance in their careers, and more Minnesota businesses would get a significant new source to support the training and retention of their current workers. These services are particularly beneficial to small businesses who need to prepare for succession planning as their workforce ages. The federal government has already moved in this area and has already identified incumbent worker training as a need for the dislocated worker program nationwide. As you know, that this program receives both federal and state dollars. So Governor Dayton's proposal would help us align state policy with the new Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act to respond to these shifting economic needs. Our proposal, again, in this area does not require new general fund spending. Instead, we're increasing the flexibility of existing state dollars for the best possible use during various economic times. DEED also provides workforce development services for youth, especially at-risk youth. These young people, often from low-income families, face major barriers to employment and risk serious setbacks in life without extra guidance in their formative years. Our youth workforce development programs include federally funded services that are provided through local workforce boards and youth councils, and they include a number of state-funded services like the Youth Build Program, for example, which offers construction career pathways for at-risk youth who have either dropped out of school or are experiencing repeated failure in school. It provides these youth with industry-recognized credentials and pre-apprenticeship training in residential construction, contextual basic skills, and soft skills in work readiness, career counseling, and leadership. Also, the state-funded Youth at Work program, which was previously known as the Workforce Development Competitive Grant Program, which we shortened to Youth at Work, utilizes a statewide network of community-based nonprofits to offer workforce development and training to economically disadvantaged at-risk youth ages 14 to 24. The program gives special consideration to youth from communities of color and those who are deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind. And finally, our Minnesota Youth Program provides summer and year-round employment and training to economically disadvantaged at-risk youth statewide ages 14 to 21. These youth are served during the summer and year-round, allowing them to get classroom skills and ability in real work settings while they also earn a paycheck. Given the strong track record of these programs, the governor recommends continued funding at current levels for the coming biennium. Another priority of DEED's workforce efforts is to ensure that people with disabilities achieve and maintain quality employment and can advance in their careers. DEED's Vocational Rehabilitation Division offers highly specialized training and services for people with a variety of disabilities that cause serious functional limitations in their life. Our Vocational Rehabilitation Program supports Minnesotans whose disabilities cause serious functional limitations in their life to achieve employment goals. Our more than 300 vocational rehabilitation counselors and VR techs work within the Minnesota workforce system to deliver services such as job assessment, skill assessment, vocational evaluation, training, vocational counseling, assistive technology, and job placement. The program is funded by both the federal and state governments. Our independent living program, jointly funded by the federal government and the state, helps Minnesotans with disabilities live with greater independence, contribute their talents and creativity, expand their options, and secure basic rights in areas such as housing, transportation, education, and employment. These services are funded through state and federal grants to 8 community-based, non-residential, nonprofit centers for independent living around the state and include independent living skills, peer counseling, support groups, transportation assistance, home or work modification, counseling, and other services. We also provide special employment programs for people with serious mental illness. Our state-funded individual placement and support program is a unique collaborative service model involving multiple agencies that provides employment services in the full context of an individual with mental health treatment services. And finally, our state-funded extended employment program provides ongoing support services to people with significant disabilities aimed at helping them not only acquire employment, but to maintain employment and advance in their careers.
Senator Dibble.
I'll let Mr. Hanson-Willis finish this presentation. I had a question about this particular program. Thanks.
Okay. The Extended Employment Program contracts with a statewide network, again, of community rehabilitation programs that provides ongoing supports to meet the needs of people with disabilities who want to work, as well as the employers who need qualified employees. The governor's budget proposal in this area includes $500,000 for the upcoming biennium to continue the legislature's one-time extended employment provider rate increases from the last biennium. Our extended employment providers are paid by deed a specific rate for each hour worked by an individual with significant disabilities, and we calculate these payments based on verified hours and wages. And in recent years, providers have struggled with the state's payment rates given the rising costs in staff and benefits that they have as nonprofit organizations. In 2014, the legislature responded to those struggles by adding a 2% increase to these rates. The governor has recommended this funding be continued. The proposal is modest and necessary, and recognizing that rates have not kept up with inflation in recent years. Without this funding continued, providers would effectively face a 2% cut in fiscal year 2016, and in turn, they would struggle to maintain their current service levels to their customers. A cut like this would be especially problematic in Greater Minnesota, where 55% of the people served by the Extended Employment Program are located. The governor also recommends $2 million over the biennium to maintain the expansion of the Individual Placement and Support Program that I noted previously that took place in state fiscal years 2014 and 15. We went from operating 6 IPS projects around the state to currently operating 23. And this funding is needed to continue these existing services. And discontinuing this funding would effectively also be a cut to services to employment for people with serious mental illness. Both of these programs, extended employment and IPS, budget recommendations from Governor Dayton will also help us meet our obligations under the Olmstead Plan.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hanson-Willis. Very coincidentally, today is the Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Lobby Day, and I just stepped out a second ago, kind of coincidentally, to chat with them. And actually, this is a matter that Senator Schmidt is working on, and I think he's out being lobbied by his citizens right now in the hallway as well. And what they told me is that there used to be funds dedicated to employment supports for deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing workers, but that money's all been put into a competitive pool, and the effect is that the resources that come to that community for this purpose were cut in half. So I was wondering if you know anything more about that. I think the proposal from Senator Schmidt, if you had a chance to see it, is to add $1.2 million per year to, I think also the resulting effect was that the grants are only made for deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing in the metro, and it's not getting to the rest of the state. And so the idea was to get those dollars to that particular community and also get them out of the metro, make these supports available outside of the metro. So it looks like someone has come to the table to help us understand these issues a little better.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, to best answer this question, I'd like to refer to Kim Peck, who's the Director of Vocational Rehabilitation Programs.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I've got I'm kind of blinded by the projector, so I apologize for that. It is true that there was a point in time where programs that were serving individuals with deaf and hard of hearing had passed through appropriations. But then the Senate moved in a few years ago to bring those together into a competitive pool. And when that happened, it certainly was problematic, frankly, for those programs that served individuals that were deaf and hard of hearing. Because those services that were funded were providing ongoing supports, and the competitive pool itself was targeted a broader need. So without question, that was problematic. And Vocational Rehabilitation Services did our best to provide bridge funding to make sure that those programs could continue to some degree.
Thank you.
So do we need more money now? Sounds like it to me.
Yeah, Senator Schmidt thinks so.
Okay.
I would agree with him.
All right.
Mary Hartnett here, who's staff to the Deaf, Blind, Hard of Hearing Commission.
Maybe we should let Senator Westrum address this.
Mr. Chair, just a question for Ms. Peck.
Okay.
I know we, a few years back, we took some additional money out of the TAM funds to dedicate to different things, and I'm trying to recall what that was. Was that part of the reorganization or something separate? And what, refresh me, what we've done with the TAM funds in recent years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, I'm not able to answer that question. However, Mary Hartnett is in the room, and I know she knows that like the back of her hand. So if you would like answers, I would, with the committee's permission.
Ms. Hartnett, just grab one of those chairs behind you there and pull it up
to the table.
Ms. Hartnett. Say your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Westrum, my name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. And Senator Westrum, I believe that you're referring in this particular committee, and actually it involved you, Kim, when I believe it had to do when we got the technology accessibility. It was actually in this committee, I believe, that we had the technology accessibility bill that was passed in 2009 that required that all websites be accessible and comply with what's called Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, which requires that IT services or online services, government services, be accessible at the same level for people with disabilities as without disabilities. And so when President Obama was elected president, he gave money to bolster the economy, and part of those funds went to vocational rehabilitation, and those monies were used to try to fund what the fiscal note that MNIT, or the department, the IT department at the state, required at the time. So it was about implementation of the state's IT technology bill that was before this committee. So, and then I believe that the TAM fund was also tapped into to fund the positions for the Chief Information Accessibility Officer that ensures that the state has accessible technology for people with disabilities within the state, and you are chief author of that.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Harton, thanks for the refresher on that one. I was thinking we had done something, and as I'm talking about it here, I don't think it's in exchange for those competitive grants that got shifted, but I was... Did we not use the TAM funds for some accessibility on television? What do they call the text at the bottom?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, you have a very good memory. That was 12 years ago.
Oh.
$300,000 a year is dedicated for...
Back when I was young.
Yes, back when you were young. $300,000 is dedicated from the TAM fund to pay for real-time captioning in Greater Minnesota. Real-time captioning is only required for news broadcasts for the 25 top news markets in the country. And so the rest of the state doesn't have to caption. And so we, in Minnesota, no matter where you are, you get live captioned news because of that bill that got passed.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
I remember one of the the captioning that was going through one of the committee hearings, and I said the word taconite, and whoever translating it put taco night.
Probably better.
All right. Go ahead. Who's, are we? Go ahead, Ms. Hartnett. You got something else to add?
This is Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill thank you very much, Senator Dibble is my senator. I'm very thankful that this was raised. We realized we were in the base for years, and we realized that the other disability groups had statutes that required that the state provide these grants to these special groups. So 268A.14 requires that services be provided, support services be provided to people with mental illness, and 268A.13 requires that people with severe disabilities have supports for employment. So we last year got a bill passed, 268A.16, that requires that they be provided for people that are deaf and hard of hearing. And this body said, yes, that should be there, but it only becomes law if there's an allocation. So we are asking for an allocation this year. It needs to happen. We need every worker that we can get to fill the jobs to make the economy strong with a less than 4%, what is it, unemployment rate. We need qualified workers to be able to work, and these supports make that happen. So.
How much do we need?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're asking for $1.2 million for transition age kids to get first-time jobs, for adults to get supports for all of Greater Minnesota, so $2.4 for the biennium.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, I do note that we are quickly running out of time, so I just have a few more programs and initiatives I'd like to highlight, and I'll try to speak as quickly as I can.
We got Monday yet.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Next Monday if we have to go.
Right. Mr. Chair, I have time if you do. So,
okay, go ahead.
We would appreciate the opportunity to speak about the totality of our work at DEED. Still in the arena of providing services to people with disabilities, you'll also notice in the governor's budget a recommendation for statutory protection from subpoena for our vocational rehabilitation services staff. Our staff in this division are sometimes served subpoenas 8 or 10 times a year. And the circumstances can vary about why this happens. It's sometimes they're asked to be involved or testify in divorce proceedings, child support cases, or occasionally criminal cases. And usually the case has no relevance to the delivery of our VR services, and responding to such subpoenas are costly and disruptive. This proposal shows up in the fiscal area because of the costs associated with responding to these subpoenas. With statutory protection, the dollars would not be spent on these responses and could be redirected to our VR customers. And our state services for the blind program helps Minnesotans who have vision loss or other disabilities, such as learning disabilities or dyslexia, that make it difficult to read print. We see a dramatic shift in Minnesota's aging population in the coming decades, and so we anticipate the need for these services to more than quadruple in future years. These services that we provide are comprehensive and designed to help individuals achieve personal and vocational independence. It includes workforce development, such as providing assistive technology and training to meet the demands of today's workforce, as well as training in cane, travel, cooking, and managing finances. Our business enterprises, which provide vending business and job-creating opportunities for entrepreneurs in over 200 locations in the state, federal buildings, are generating $7 million in annual sales. Senior Services, which is a component of this program, provides seniors facing vision loss with tools, training, and technology to remain in their homes and live as independently as possible. And our Communications Center, which provides materials in multiple accessible formats, audio, braille, and e-text, for education, work, and individual independence. Again, the governor's budget recognizes the importance of these programs and services and proposes to continue funding at current levels. And finally, Mr. Chair, I'd like to touch briefly on an important interagency initiative that members of this committee have likely heard, and one that has a major impact on people with disabilities. You're likely familiar with the 1999 U.S. Supreme Court decision Olmstead versus LC, which found that the Americans with Disabilities Act required states to provide services to people with disabilities in the most integrated settings appropriate to their needs. The court came to this decision for two reasons. First of all, that segregation of individuals with disabilities perpetuates the notion that these individuals are incapable or unworthy of participating fully in community life. And second, that such segregation severely diminishes that person's life, family relations, social contacts, work options, economic independence, educational advancement, and cultural enrichment. Relatedly, in 2011, the Minnesota Department of Human Services also entered into a settlement agreement that required the development of a Minnesota-specific Olmstead plan.
This plan was developed over 2 years by a committee that included individuals with disabilities, family members, service providers, advocates, the Olmstead Subcabinet, which is a group of eight state agencies, which not only includes DEED, but also education, corrections, health, human services, human rights, MnDOT, and the Housing Finance Agency, established by Governor Dayton. The goals of this effort include, for example, commitments to individuals who are unnecessarily segregated in facilities for individuals with development disabilities, psychiatric hospitals, nursing homes, and board and care homes. To implement these changes in the agreed-upon timeline, we have established the Olmstead Implementation Office. The office is responsible for providing accountability, coordination among all these different state agencies, engagement with the community, and conducting the required quality of life survey. The Olmstead office is also involved with all of the state agencies in our work overseen by the Olmstead Subcabinet. DEED currently serves as the fiscal agent for the office, even though it's a multi-agency effort. To accomplish the vital mission of the office, Governor Dayton proposes $850,000 increase for the implementation office in the coming biennium. Federal court monitors are closely watching the progress of Minnesota's Olmstead Plan implementation to ensure that we comply with the Jensen Settlement Agreement. We believe this appropriation is an important part of demonstrating the state's commitment to those goals.
So is the $850,000 based on the number of FTEs that you're adding to the office? Is that what it is, or what is that?
Mr. Chair and members, it's primarily focused on the FTEs required and also the quality of life survey, which is a key monitoring tool.
Okay. And how much is the office getting now?
Mr. Chair,
$1.2 million, is that what it is?
I can easily answer that question. Mr. Chair, it was $500,000 in the first year, and in the second year being this one, $875,000. So the governor's proposal is a similar amount of current funding levels.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, we started this this was funded last year in the big budget bill, and they were given $500,000 for fiscal year 15 and then $875,000 for the base budget for this coming biennium. And what the department is asking for is another $425,000 per year on top of that $875,000. So it would go from $500,000 to $1.3
million. Okay. And then, so with this and the broadband, and I'm not sure I picked up on the other ones, how much is the total increase for the DEED budget request of general fund money this year? Do we know that?
45 million.
I think Mr. Mueller has a handle on what. Go ahead, Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, the total general fund request, including broadband, which is $30 million, is $33.427 million. So, yeah, the other big ones were the extended employment services and then this Olmstead office and then broadband were pretty much. There's a little bit of compensation increase that all state agencies requested for the 1.8%. But some of that would come out of the Workforce Development Fund and some out of general fund with the department.
Okay, and there was no increased request for MIF or the Job Employment Fund, right? Those are just, they're revolving loan funds, right? Both of them are?
Mr. Chair, the Minnesota Investment Fund is. The Job Creation Fund is not.
And we're not asking for more money there?
We are not asking for
more. How much is left in that fund, do you know?
There is about, in the Job Creation Fund, there's about $9 million remaining, which are basically, most of it's going to be announced here over the next several months, so we're quite confident that we'll be out of money. And then the Minnesota Investment Fund, there is about $12 million left that basically will also be awarded here over the next several months.
Okay. Okay. Any questions from the committee? Anything further, gentlemen?
Well, Mr. Chair, we thank you for the opportunity.
All right, thank you. And it's my understanding we're having Commissioner Tingerthal here next Wednesday, March 11th, and I guess Deed is going to be back, and we're going to address this Olmsted issue again, so take a closer look at it. All right? So, all right, thank you, everybody, then. Meeting adjourned.